Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So you were saying you've listened to a total of three podcasts?
I think it's three, yeah. I listened to a couple of podcasts by The Trap, a sketch group.
Okay.
That I thought were very funny, and I've listened to Stephen Fry. Now, I'm never quite sure whether they're podcasts. If you buy them on iTunes, is that a podcast?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, that'll be a podcast. Yeah, he did one about... poetry, I think. It's quite interesting.
He did a really famous one with Richard Herring. I don't know if you heard that one.
No.
Okay.
No, what was that about?
Richard Herring does a comedy podcast.
Right. Okay.
Called Rehellastapa, and it's Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. Right. And it's he invites people on and asks some sort of odd questions, and one of them was, "What's it like being Stephen Fry?" And he talked very openly about his depression and suicide. And Richard still managed to make it quite amusing because he kept sort of jumping in.
Good. Well, I should imagine Stephen Fry made it quite amusing.
Even
talking about depression. He's a clever chap.
Yeah.
So, which is the most famous podcast in Britain?
That's a tricky one. Do you mean in the comedy section?
Yes.
Or, I would probably say it's one of Richard Herring's.
Okay.
Just he gets a lot of I interviewed him for a book I've just written, and we were talking about what he got out of, because he gives them away for free like I do.
Yep.
And what you get from that, and his exposure to that has like four times his audience.
Yeah.
So
okay.
Even though he said it was very small at the start, but he's still able to get, you know, sort of 200, 300 people.
Four times one person is only still, four people. Yeah,
it's still better than one.
Yes.
Assuming they're quality audience members that aren't going to...
Yeah, well, Jesus started with 12, didn't he?
So. he did all right, didn't he?
He did all right.
It's like, I was talking to Nick Helm, we were talking about him before we started.
Yeah.
I was chatting to him on a train, actually, and he was saying that when he did Uncle, it started to bring in a whole new batch of people that were expecting him to do Uncle in stand-up.
Oh, right, yeah.
And if you've seen his stand-up, it's nothing like that.
I've seen his stand-up many times, yes. No. Yeah, of course, we made Uncle, of course.
Yeah. He was just saying that it was just a really interesting wave of people that started to come and see him live, and it was quite hard to, because he had walkouts and things, because obviously, if you can imagine.
Yeah. No, it's far gentler, Uncle, than his usual stand-up, although I like both, so you can get people who like both.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure you do. He was just saying there was a lot of
disappointed
people that were expecting him to be that character.
Hello, and welcome to the Ask Your Industry podcast, episode 52. For those of you new to the show, my name's Simon Kane, and this is the podcast where I interview the most influential people from the worlds of stand-up, comedy, radio, and today, TV. Although, to be honest, I'm probably doing our guest this week quite a disservice, because he has been in all of those mediums. He started out his career as a poet, he then went to be a writer, then a TV producer, then a script editor, and then eventually founding the production company Baby Cow with his friend Steve Coogan, which has gone on to create some of the biggest hit comedy shows of the last decade, including Uncle, Gavin and Stacey, The Mighty Boosh, and of course the legendary comedy character Alan Partridge. We get into how he got his start in the industry, why he got into the industry, what drives him to try different projects, how he picks different projects, and just so many different things. including why he picked the stage name, how he came to that stage name, why he got reviewed in the Telegraph as the funniest man you've never heard of, and why he sort of stays under the radar and likes being able to walk down the street and not be noticed by people. I had such a great time. Honestly, I know I say this a lot, but he was just so open and so honest and so humble about everything. So I just think we got so much good stuff out of him. I'm not going to say much more because this is a mega pod. It's a really long one. But me and him sat down and we chatted for probably twice as long as this podcast has come out to be, just because we were just getting on and it was just a really nice afternoon where I lost track of time. I think he lost track of time. And it's just nice. It was just a genuinely lovely guy who clearly just knows what he's talking about and has been around long enough to really give some great insights. And I hope you get some stuff out of this. I think this podcast would be great for anyone who wants to make their start in TV, who is interested in Baby Cow Productions in general, who wants to know a bit more of the behind the scenes of the radio, script editing, scripting, writing, TV. I can't imagine it not having something applicable to most people working in the live medium or TV or radio today. So pass it on if you think that you know someone who will enjoy it just as much as you have. If you would like to support the podcast, please subscribe and you'll get told in your inbox when we have a new episode out. I do 3 a month, one every 10 days. So if you want to know when the next one's out, that's the best way of doing it. If you have 20 seconds, please give us a review in iTunes. We're up to 47 reviews now. It would be great if we get that over 50. I would just love to get back to when we had more reviews than episodes. That'd be incredible, but no pressure there if you don't have time or you don't want to, or you've already done it and you don't want to make a second iTunes account. Totally understand. However, it does help with the rankings, or that's what I've been told, and also it helps with future guests because they read them and they think, oh great, there's a great audience there, we'll come on. I've just had Imando Emanucci sign up to this podcast, which I'm so excited about having the interview for, and I've got another guest, I can't say it yet, it's driving me mad, because if we get them, they're massive, and yeah, just join up, or join the Facebook group, which is called Ask the Industry Podcast, and it's on Facebook, obviously. That will be the best place to find out when this and other guests get announced, and also you can ask some questions there. I open it up to the forum, so if you have anything to ask future guests, join the group and you'll be the first person to find out, first of all, when they've signed up, and second of all, when you can ask some questions. Without any more delays, this is Henry Normal.
So we were talking about podcasts and what defines a podcast. Now I was asking whether Mid-Morning Matters was a podcast.
For me, a podcast, the beauty of a podcast is that it can be any length, because on TV or radio you have a set sort of, you know, like 28, I think it's 28 minutes for like a BBC half hour or something like that. And for me, for example, these episodes range between an hour and, I think the longest one I did was with Hell's Jager, which is about 3 hours long. And we literally spent an afternoon chatting, and that took forever to edit.
So apart from the duration, how else would you define what makes a podcast?
I think the medium at which you consume it. So that's why I think Mid-Morning Matters, the online ones, I'd sort of count a bit as a podcast.
So a podcast you have to listen to on a computer?
Not necessarily.
Or a phone?
Yeah, you can. I mean, you can download it on any device and take it with you.
But it's a downloaded thing as opposed to anything else. So it's downloaded, it can be any length.
Yeah.
And is it, I mean, if it was music, is that a podcast?
There are music podcasts. I don't know if you would class, you wouldn't class a song as a podcast.
Right, so if it was somebody doing a concert in their living room, would that be a podcast?
That could be a podcast, yeah.
And if it was somebody doing a concert with 200 people watching, would that be a podcast?
That could go out as a podcast, yeah.
Okay, so the reason why you wouldn't class one song as a podcast is why?
Because that's just an MP3 track. So it's kind of... So if you were to record an hour of like your gig in someone's living room, for example, it would have more than just the songs. It would have the in-between bits and the live moments that might happen in the room and all that kind of stuff, and it's also how you release it. So if you release that as an hour, like on iTunes as a free download, as a clip in itself, that would make it, that would put it in the podcast section rather than a
So to try and find a definition between having one song that you could record, say, in your living room, and having a song and some chat and another song, and that being a podcast, the difference being that you that it's not a composite bit of art, that it's more of a bag of bits?
Sort of. Yeah, I suppose that's. I've not looked at it like that before, but that's.
But you can. I mean, there are albums, aren't there? That you know, they're 90 minutes long, and it's essentially one bit of music.
Yeah. So it. I suppose it comes. So you could release a song as a podcast if you wanted to.
So it's about intention.
Yes, as well.
So what's the difference between the intention of a podcast and the intention of something that's not a podcast?
Generally, I have to talk generally in this.
Yeah.
Podcasts are there for exposure and free entertainment,
okay,
or free knowledge, rather than. And I mean, you can charge for them. Like there are methods of making your, I think they're called podcast premiums or premium podcast or something like that.
Yeah.
So you can like charge per download if you want to.
Yeah.
Personally, I don't do that, and I don't know many other performers that do, because you need to build the audience of.
So in terms of intention, you could say then that it's not about a financial gain.
No, it's about something else.
Right. So if you were to do anything free, and it's on the internet, that's a podcast.
It's interesting. I'm trying to work out whether I would. So because technically now you can have video podcasts.
Yeah,
you could class a YouTube clip as a podcast.
Yeah, why don't we?
I think the lines are blurring, like as in all mediums.
Yeah,
because newspapers used to be printed, and now they're essentially blogs, and TV used to just be on TV, and now it's online as well, or can be syndicated online. And podcasts started as sort of an indie version of radio, if you like, and now they can be anything, really, because they can be visual. Oh. So I suppose if you wanted a specific definition, there's probably one out there, but I don't.
Do you know what I might do? I might Google it.
Yeah, I was going to say. We're
Google podcasts and see what they say.
I'm going to Google it while we're recording.
It might be one of those things where there's a lot of names for the same thing.
Okay.
Do you know, like talk and chat, and they're all versions of the same thing, but they have different connotations.
Yeah.
So
the Wikipedia entry definition for podcast is: a podcast is a form of digital media that consists of an episodic series of audio, video, digital radio, PDF or EPUB files subscribed to and downloaded from an automatic web syndication or streamed online to a computer or mobile device.
Well, that
says
it perfectly, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Why didn't you say that in the first place?
I'm not a professional, like the Wikipedia, like the I can't find the name of the person edited this.
Well, it's an amalgam of people. Yeah, it's probably more than one person.
Yeah,
I'm probably asking too much of you as a single person to compete with Wikipedia.
Yes.
All right. Well, we'll get on with our podcast, and now we know what it is.
This is definitely a podcast.
Good.
I'm calling it that, so it's sticking with the label. Even though labels are damaging and probably not a good idea in the 21st century. But that's a whole other podcast we can do.
Life's too short not to have labels.
Okay.
You could almost make that into a label itself, couldn't
you?
Yeah,
that sounds like a what I love is, I just went into your toilet and you've got a sign, like lots of people have like sort of captions and stuff in their house, and yours says, as far as anyone knows, we're a normal family.
Yes.
Did you mean that as punny as it came off?
That was bought by somebody for us, obviously knowing that my writing name's Henry Normal.
Right.
It is quite apt. I think my wife put it there, and I'm complicit in that I don't move it.
Fair enough. I've lived with an ex-girlfriend before, and I just let her put everything where she wanted to.
That's the best way, I find.
Mm-hmm. Let's start there then. Why did you go with a pen name?
Well, I was probably around early 20s, and punk had started, and there were people with all sorts of strange names, and I wanted to be a poet, and there were a few poets around which I liked, like Attila the Stockbroker and Seething Wells and Little Brother, and they all seemed to have these strange names. And I was working as an insurance broker, but I was on a lunchtime. I used to nip off to the local college and I'd do a gig and then I'd nip back, so I'd have my suit on. So both in order that my employer didn't know that I was performing and sometimes being paid, and so that I could counter any eccles from the audience. I thought, well, I'll have myself a name that does the job. So I thought by calling myself Henry Normal, I'd already usurped the the sort of derision of the crowd, because obviously a lot of the bands didn't wear suits in those days. Yeah. The reason I chose the name Henry was that it was a name of a generation or two above me, that nobody my age would have the name Henry. And you'll probably find that people like Frank Skinner, whose real name's Chris, and Vic Reeves, they tend to choose names of the previous generation. I think partly because comedy, you tend to think of as being, certainly in those days, you tended to think of as being an older person's profession.
Interesting. Okay.
So give a sort of authority.
Yeah. I can understand. There's a lot of friends of mine who are teachers in the day and in the night do comedy.
Yeah.
And so they have to have a separate name so that their students can't Google them, if you like.
Yeah.
So that makes perfect sense from that. But yeah. I don't think they've ever thought about it in terms of trying to go up a generation.
I think that's what it seemed to me, and it was quite nice because obviously people would think I was boring because I'd got a suit on, that I'd have a name that signified that, so that, you know, I wasn't trying to be something flash. Mm. So it seemed sort of quite reductive. So the other great thing was that it sort of liberates you in a certain way, that you can take on another persona. I think a lot of people do that, don't they, when they get into, for want of a better word, showbiz. That, you know, when you're actually on the stage, you're a heightened version of yourself. And those that aren't an heightened version of themselves usually are a pain in the arse when they're off stage.
Right.
So to have that definition between the two, I thought was great. I remember Elvis Costello, who's obviously not really called Elvis Costello, did some gigs in his is it Declan McManus, I think his real name is, did some gigs in his real name about a year after I'd started, and it slightly annoyed me that he tried to change his name back. So I sort of made a pact with myself, my two selves, that I would never do that. So I've always retained the name Henry Normal, even though, you know, there's no real need for it when I was at Baby Cow.
So do you prefer to be called Henry then?
Everybody calls me Henry.
Okay.
My wife calls me Henry.
So have you legally changed your name?
No.
Okay. So if post comes here, does it come to Henry?
If it's for my passport, no.
Obviously,
if it's a lot of other posts, yes.
I tried to, I opened a bank account, I tried to get them to put Sir on my letters. They wouldn't let me do it. Like, because the thing is, it had an option on it when you signed up online to collect Sir, and I did that, and they rang me up and said, you can't do that. So I went back and did Doctor, but then they rang me and asked for my a copy of my doctorate.
Did they really?
Yeah, it was really annoying.
you didn't say that's my first name, Doctor.
No, it was the suffix.
Oh.
Yeah. Just trying to annoy banks.
No, you should not. You should keep your head down with banks. Banks and police, keep your head down.
Okay. It was more, and this will probably get edited out, but it was more I joined the bank literally to use their coin counting machine and transfer it to another bank that I actually use.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because I do the free fringe, as I mentioned. Yeah. So I get a bucket of change, and Metro Bank let you pour your change into their machine, and they give you a slip that lets it go into their account.
I've never been a fan of banks. I've never trusted them. I remember when I was young, I used to get on the back of crisp packets. Used to get fantastic facts, and I remember reading one that said a woman in Mexico would go to the bank every day, take her money out, count it, and put it back. And I've always had a very similar sort of attitude that I deal with them as least as I can.
Fair enough. Yeah, I try and stay away from them.
Banks, lawyers, police, anything official.
Okay. Is that why you're doing a podcast now?
Because it's not official. Not official, is it? We're not signed any papers or nothing.
Nope.
I can deny this ever happened.
And I can edit it to make you look worse than maybe you might do later.
You probably have.
He's not said anything contentious, offensive, or sexist or racist, so if it comes out that way, it's in my edit. That's
that'll be the last of it, yeah.
Well, because I spoke to Phil Jupitus last year in Edinburgh, and he was obviously Porky the Poet when he started up. And I remember talking to Stuart Lee as well when he was saying that, like, he saw Ted Chippington open for The Fall and stuff.
Yes.
And so, I mean, can you paint a slight picture for people that maybe are listening to this who have never opened for a band or are wondering what it was like as a comedy poet opening for a punk band?
Well, the problem was at the time there wasn't any comedy clubs, and so I was based in Manchester and Chesterfield during this time. Started off in Chesterfield, then moved to Manchester. And you had to try and perform where you could do. So you'd perform at jazz clubs, folk clubs, any place. I remember performing in Stockport at some corporate civic do that on before me were can-can dancers, and then I remember being at a place in Sheffield where there was the stage was just a mattress, and the bloke on before me just read Winnie the Pooh. So you just try and find places to perform, and there weren't any money in it at the time, so it was just try and do what you can. Now, as I was into punk music, new wave, in lots of different forms, as a big Elvis Costello fan, big Talking Heads fan, I happened to come across in Chesterfield some bands like Pulp, Dig Viz Drill, Mr. Morality, and a lot of bands who all knew each other, and it was a great community spirit. So I started doing gigs with some of these bands, and there was a community arts aspect to it, and most of the crowd seemed up for it, and I think people wanted entertainment that wasn't as slick and overproduced as they'd been getting. So there was a certain anarchy to it that worked in favour of being young and not quite knowing what you're doing, but trying to do something different. So I'd be on with three bands, and I'd do the little bits in between while still moving all the equipment around. I don't think I ever had any particularly bad experience. I remember doing a Battle of the Bands competition once, and the thing about Battle of the Bands competitions are that you come to support your band. So when all the other bands are on, you basically don't like all the other bands. So if there's eight bands, then you know you hate seven of them and love one of them. And so I had to be on all the way through, so I think essentially not only did they hate the other seven bands, but they hated me. But I unified them all in the fact that all eight supporters of the eight bands
hated
me. But I I enjoyed it, and it was fun. And but there was a sort of sense of it didn't really matter. It didn't really matter if it went according to plan or whether it went askew, because it was all experimental. There wasn't. I get a sense nowadays there's more of a corporate a game plan to everything, whereas I don't think any of us had a game plan. I mean, I was doing poetry. I mean, what game plan is there for doing poetry? You're never going to buy a house doing poetry. That's not how it's going to happen, you know. So there wasn't a long-term thought process. It was more about expressionism.
So in terms of when was it? So you were in your 20s?
So I was born in 56, so I was 20 in 76. So I would say I started around 24. So we're talking, 79 through early 80s.
Well, because there's been a sort of an explosion on the circuit in comedy,
yeah,
of people giving it a go, if you like, and,
yeah,
and trying to try. And I think a big part of that is because there's a lot of comedy on TV,
yeah,
so it looks like an avenue that has a sort of career path and a progression that people can see.
It does now, yeah. Yeah,
yeah. And when you started, it doesn't sound like there was anything like that.
Well, there was nobody on television. It was all old school, so it was all your Jim Davisons and your Jimmy Tarbox and things like that. And I wasn't interested in that at all. My influences previously had been Marx Brothers, Jack Benny, Lenny Bruce, Mort Sahl, a lot of New York Jewish comedy. So I felt I was part of a tradition of vaudeville rather than an English working class tradition. There was something more glamorous about that. So if I played Aberdeen was on a train back or a car back at 3 o'clock in the morning with 50 quid in my pocket, in my head it was the romance of, you know, following in the footsteps of Groucho Marx. It wasn't, I wasn't thinking, oh, and this will get me on the television and I'll have a seaside summer special.
And how long from when you first started to when you, I mean, for me, I got my first paid gig, number 50, and then I didn't get another one for probably another 75 or 80. So that was just the way mine panned out. I mean, did it get to a stage where you were going around the place and then all of a sudden you were getting paid because there were clubs and there were places to do this? Or was it a case of bands? Because I'm going to be open for a lot of bands. So, you know, did it get to a stage where, because they had budget to pay you to get you on the bill? Or how did it even work?
It was very ad hoc. The first couple of gigs I did were for a writer's group, and it was, we all just performed for the joy of performing. And that got me into the fact that I could perform, and that's quite an hurdle to get over, that you can actually stand up there and you're not too shy, and obviously when you get a laugh it's quite addictive, so that was nice. Then I performed at I think the first paid gig was Spots Cabaret, which was, I mean, it was called Cabaret. It had everything going on so they'd have music and they'd have novelty acts and all sorts of things. So it wasn't like, say, Jonglers, where, you know, you do a 20-minute or a 10-minute set and it's all comedy. This was far more like an arts-based thing rather than a comedy-based thing. So I think I got 30 quid for that, and I think I did about 10 minutes. Now back then, the idea of doing 10 minutes work and getting 30 quid sounded great to me. So I started performing, but it's nice getting paid, but it's more about learning the art of doing it. So I'd take any opportunity, and as I mentioned earlier, there wasn't any sort of system as such. You just had to go with the flow on it. There was a thing called the Poetry Secretariat, where if you were a poet, you could apply to the Poetry Secretariat, and they would pay the producer of the gig, they would pay them £70. And they'd be able to pass that on to you. So I'm sure Porky the Poet and Tiller and a lot of the people around the time would apply for those things. And within a year, you could probably get, I don't know, 10 to 20 of these £70 payments. So what tended to happen in the north was that people would put on comedy events and then at least put one poet on. And sometimes you get the £70 and then you would actually spread it around the other acts as well. So, you know, I performed at a place in Manchester where called Tameside Theatre, and it's where Steve Coogan started when he was about 20. And, you know, we'd only get in 10 to 20 people. And so you weren't going to make a fortune on the actual receipts. So something like having a bit of arts funding helped a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot less arts funding now.
Yeah, with the bands, very often we didn't get paid at all. I mean, I remember going with Pulp and Digby's Drill, unloading all the equipment at a place, I think Malvern, setting up. Not one person turned up, so we took all the equipment back, put it in the van, and drove back to Sheffield.
Long drive.
So, yeah, it is a long drive. After there's a chap who used to run the band Digby's Drill called Oggy. He was a lovely bloke. And I think he sort of formed this idea of Outrage Entertainments, which is a banner we used to go out under. I remember one particular gig where we went to the Morecambe Beer Keller. We arrived at Morecambe Beer Keller. It was called Lucifer's. And we put up all the equipment, and there's three bands, so there's a lot of equipment. Mm. And the first band, I think it was Midnight Choir, started to do their sound check, and the man who owned the beer keller paid us off. We pulled the equipment back in, and we drove back, and I always remember driving back in a van that said Outrage on the side of it, and there we just took the money and drove off.
Amazing. Oh, God. But I mean, for you, I was saying that would also be quite disappointing because you wanted the creative outlet. So
yes, but we were having fun as a group of people setting out on a journey. So you know, as you say, on that particular night, it was disappointing. But the whole atmosphere of what you were doing and what you were doing next week and that was, I thought, very romantic.
Mm. Yeah, I find it's very easy to romanticise the circuit, even now with the way that it is.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I have a habit of doing that in life anyway, but it's very easy when you're sort of, you know, on the train back to get through it to go.
But you got to remember, I'd been an insurance broker from the age of 17. So the idea of sitting in an office, pushing a pen, and that being for the rest of your life. This was exciting. Mm. Whether something happened or nothing happened, you were off on a journey. So I got to a stage when I'd been made the manager of the Hull office. So I'd moved up to Hull, and everybody I talked to were in their 50s, and I was 20. Punk had started happening, and Too Much Too Young in the charts. I was there putting my knives in the knife drawer and my forks in the fork bit and my spoons in the spoon bit and getting matching crockery and thinking, I'm old. What am I doing? I'm old. And then I went to see Animal House with Belushi. And there's all these people who looked older than me, even though they're supposed to be students. And they were having fun. And I just thought, well, that's it. I'm going to have some fun.
Yeah. No, that's a good philosophy behind it. I mean, I told you I'm a writer during the day, but that does involve going to an office and sitting down and sort of scheduling out tweets for brands, essentially.
Yeah.
Which you, I mean, when I tell someone, oh, I write jokes for Twitter, it's easy for them to romanticise, oh, you spend all day on Twitter.
Like, that's romantic, is it?
Well, no, because a lot of people like wasting time on social media, so the fact that I get paid to do that can be very easy for them to go.
Yeah, but you perform at gigs and nights.
Yeah.
So that to me, that's more of a, you know, the fact that you get up in front of people and you've thought something up, which you then try to communicate. I would have thought, to me, that's the more romantic bit than the Twitter bit.
It depends on which group of people I'm talking to.
Right.
Like, people in offices.
Is it sad people and happy people?
Yeah. People in offices think, oh, you get to spend all day on social media. That must be great.
Right,
and people who are in, like, come to gigs and things get excited about the fact that you perform. So, and I suppose they are much happier than the people in offices.
Yeah, I'm afraid I don't quite understand the lure of social media.
Are you on any social media?
My wife's put me on Facebook, and occasionally I'll put something out on that because apparently that's what you're supposed to do.
But not
really.
Okay.
I don't think I'd be on. I tried to go on Twitter because I wanted to follow the Alan Partridge Twitters. So I started up a Twitter account and I put my password in. I think I put my son's name in, Johnny, and they said, no, you can't have that. And I put my wife's name in, Angela, and they said, no, you can't have that. And then I put a couple of other ones in and said, you can't have that. So I just put in, you are a cunt. And they let me have that as the password.
Fair enough. I hope that account doesn't exist anymore. You're going to have a lot of people. Right. And just to verify, that isn't also your bank details.
No,
though, right?
No, that's not my password for the bank. Yeah.
I mean, it might be. You don't like banks. So how long were you in insurance? I mean, how long were you learning the craft? Because I don't do poetry. I have no idea. I think I wrote one poem at school.
Yeah.
That's about it. I mean, how long does it take for you to become a poet, as it were? Like, ooh, how long were you still doing insurance?
That's a very good question, but I think it's I think it differs for different people. So there's two types of poetry. There's comic verse, and then there's poetry where you're trying to express a little bit more meaningful. And I read Spike Milligan's Small Dreams of a Scorpion when I was about 18, and because Spike Milligan I'd always found to be really funny and would make me cry of laughing, and I loved the Goon shows and I loved all his books, the fact that he was so serious in Small Dreams of a Scorpion really impressed me, and there was something about the accessibility of what he was doing that I loved. And I saw John Cooper Clarke, I saw Roger McGough, and I read Brian Patton and Adrian Mitchell. And there was something, I'd say, accessible about them all that I thought there's something slightly more substantial than what I was hearing in stand-up at the time. So that was a path I chose. As to whether you get any good, I've no idea. I mean, anybody can make a rhyme. I would like to think some of the stuff that I'm doing now after a 20-year absence is better than the stuff I did in my 20s.
But I assume you've been writing poems in that 20 years?
No, not written a thing.
Okay. Well, I mean, you've written stuff, but you've just not written poems.
Well, I've not written poems, yeah. Not written anything of a personal nature.
Okay. And so how long were you a poet?
I started writing in my teens, and then I found my way in Manchester. Then I'd met Caroline Ahern and Steve and Frank Skinner used to come up and do gigs. So we all sort of knew each other. And then I did Edinburgh, which was fantastic because I met a lot of other people on a similar journey. And the first Edinburgh I did was with Atty Eyridge at the Assembly Rooms, who did the old... I actually won an award, which I don't normally mention. I won the Daily Mail New Comic Award. I think it only lasted for 1 year. I think I'm probably the only person who's ever won it. I don't think I'd mentioned it to Steve, because he's not a big fan of the Daily Mail. But it was nice to be recognised, and I was given a TV show my first year up there. So I think they wanted John Egley to do a TV show and he didn't want to do one. So as I was a poet, I think they came to see me. It was the John Blair Film Company. Joe Sargent, who's still a very good producer, said, do you want to do a show? And I said, yes. Said, well, what show do you want to do? And I said, well, let's do a live version of The Muppets with me as Kermit. So I wanted Frank to be a sort of Fozzie Bear gonzo character. I wanted Linda Smith to be the Miss Piggy, shall we say. They weren't keen on Linda Smith. She seemed too serious for them, so they suggested Jenny Eclair. I didn't know Jenny, but, I mean, she was brilliant for the part, and I thought she did it really well. So I can understand that. I managed to get Linda in on one of the episodes. We did a series of that for Channel 4, and it's the first time Steve had done a character on national TV. He played my brother on it. So that was nice. So so I'd got a foot in the door of television. I got to meet a lot of new people, and we got all my mates on the television. We got Dave Gorman's first television was Packet of Three. But the problem for me was that in my one-hour shows, I would do long poems and serious poems and funny poems and little asides, and it was a sort of a salad, if you like, of different things. Whereas the TV just wanted the very short, pithy ones. So I got sort of cornered into a being a part of my personality as opposed to the full personality. In a way, the best thing that happened was that even though I'd created the show, they asked me not to be in the second series.
Okay.
It wouldn't happen these days because I'd make sure it was in the contract. But at the time, I was quite relieved because I didn't have any more little pithy material, because all the other material was longer and some of it was serious. So I was quite happy with that.
No, I was going to ask how much creative control you actually got over that, because I imagine you would, I mean, yeah, TV's known as something that, you know, they have sort of specific requirements for length and specific requirements for, I think at the moment there's, in some departments, you know, laughs per minute and structures and things like yeah. that. So I'm wondering.
I don't think the knowledge that we gained later on, none of us had at that time, and I don't think the producers had that awareness of it. Certainly, I'd never acted before, and nobody in any stage of that production said, can you act? This is how you act. This is what'll help you. It was just, you do stand up on the stage. Here's a show. Do something. So we were all doing our best. I thought it was a funny show. I don't think artistically it would stack up against great shows, but it was a fun show to do, and we were trying to do something different. I was very happy to get back to doing live shows, and that, so then I went to Edinburgh and did a show called Henry Normal's Encyclopedia Poetica. I thought, in actual fact, only I knew that I wasn't on the second series. So I thought, I'll whilst only I know about it, I'll do something decent that I'm proud of. So I did that show, and I got given a radio series on the back of that, which I think was a bit nearer what I'd hoped to achieve, and that was me doing a selection of poems, longer ones and some serious ones, and I had a guest poet on those. That was a Radio 4 series, so I enjoyed doing that. And then, of course, Caroline was offered the Mrs. Merton show, and Steve Coogan was offered Saturday Zoo doing Paul Calf, and they asked me to write for them. So I started earning money as a writer, and you can earn a lot more money writing gags for comedians on television than you can from gigging. Yeah, because I was writing for both of them, so I was basically doing two. So if you look at the early years of doing that, we wrote three series of the Mrs. Merton show, and I was writing Coogan's Run, Tony Farino, and Paul and Pauline Calf video diaries. So by working with both of them, I had quite a lot of output, and they all won awards. You know, it was great fun working with Caroline. Dave Gorman was on the first two series of the Mrs. Merton show, so he was good fun to work with, and Craig. I worked predominantly with Steve on Coogan's Run and Tony Farina.
And so you've done your first series of that. That was a British series, so it was like eight episodes or six episodes, wasn't it?
I think it was eight episodes of 45 minutes. It was quite a big one.
Well, actually, I was going to go back slightly and ask, when you did your first show, which you were only in the first series of, how long did it take for you? Because you've never done TV before. So I'm wondering, how much support you got with that, and because it sounds like it was very, like you said, chaotic but organic, because you were all sort of working in tandem towards, was it like a creative goal that you all had, or?
Going up to do Edinburgh, then obviously you knew that television people were coming, so that was part of the objective of going up there. So I was asked at Edinburgh if I wanted to do a show. Then Joe Sargent and I went round to try and find a theatre, and we found the Wakefield Opera House, which I'd performed in before. I did a little tour with Frank Skinner and Joe Brand and some other people for Red Stripe, I think it was, and we'd done that that venue. So we chose that. Having got Frank and Jenny on the show, sort of wrote it together. We were given a couple of script editors. I think the whole thing took less than a year. I didn't feel that we were very much in control of it. Not in the way that I would expect people who worked with Baby Cow now to feel more in control, and certainly with some of the lessons that I learnt from trying to write stuff and perform. We've carried forward into the producing. But after that series, as I say, I stepped back more to be a writer. I wasn't happy with my performing skills in terms of doing that bit of material that they seem to want for the comedy. I love doing the live stuff, and I could do longer pieces and do some serious pieces and just generally be a bit freer. But the idea of, you know, cramming something into small sections, and I don't know, just I felt a little bit like Bernie Winters, which is not good, or Schnorbitz on a bad day, or even Mike Winters. I'm going down a scale now to well unfunny. So I was very happy to just do the live stuff and, as I say, write. So it's great writing for Steve, because he is a very funny man and very good at on the television, and Caroline as well. So we had some fun with those shows. We even got Steve on the Mrs. Merton show, which was funny, because I both took part in the writing of the questions and talking to Steve about his answers.
Well, I was only asking because it sounded like it was quite an intensive process, which meant that you maybe weren't able to do live stuff throughout that time. Or were you still gigging as a in the evening? I assume by this point you're not an insurance broker.
Oh, yeah, no. I gave up the insurance when I left Chesterfield. No, I was trying to do it. I went on the Enterprise Allowance Scheme back in, this is in Thatcher's time, where they give you £40 a week to set up your own business. And I set up as a poet. And then I think I went, you have to be off it for a year and then you can set up again as something else. And I think I set up as a comedian on the second time. And you could at that time. I think they'd not quite sussed out that everybody in the arts was taking this enterprise allowance scheme. I think probably after about 3 years they shut it down and you weren't allowed to go on it as a writer or a comedian.
Interesting. Okay. A lot of people who've been around, I'd say 20 or 30 years, have said that they wouldn't have had their sort of... you know, like when a plane's taking off, it sort of does that sort of period without the enterprise. And
well, you know, it was a regular £40. You didn't have to keep looking behind you to see whether or not anybody was following you for taking cash in hand. I mean, I remember, you know, I had a small flat and probably wear the same clothes every day of the week. And I remember having, you know, 5p in my pocket sometimes, just waiting for the next £40 to come in. But there was a feeling that this wasn't going to be for the rest of your life. This was the sort of the bit before you got, you know, you got recognition or you got to do something. You know, there's sort of if it had been safer and luxurious, I don't think it'd have had the same bohemian feel to it.
Yeah, I get what you mean. It's just enough to help you, but not enough to make you complacent.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And so I'd say your first big moment, as it were, as in like your step up would have been when you got that TV show, the first TV show?
And doing Edinburgh itself was a big thing, and you know, headlining a bill, the first time you headline a bill and people actually pay money to come and see you and your name's, you know, at the top, or it's just you, it's just a one-man show and they've come to see you. Those are big things, aren't they? As opposed to, you know, people not knowing what they're going to come and see, and you go on and you do 5, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, whatever, and doing well. I mean, that's, that in itself is a big thing. So that they're all little milestones that you should appreciate and enjoy, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And then you sort of changed direction to be a writer. And what was the next milestone in writing for you?
Well, I was very lucky. I've always been lucky in choosing people to work with, but Mrs. Merton Show won all the awards. Paul and Pauline Calf Video Diaries won awards, won BAFTAs. And so immediately we were, you know, all successes, you know, as writers and creators. So it just seemed to happen instantaneously. I mean, for years when I was writing with Caroline and Craig, Caroline would say, they haven't found us out yet. You know, there was always that sense that we'd managed to get into the doors of television without people realising that we were a bunch of scallies.
Yeah, I think everyone goes through that.
I'm sure they do. The controllers, I'm sure, are the same. You know, let's face it, they all game overpaid for basically doing, you know, just talking, drinking tea, wearing suits. It's not proper work, is it?
I'm not going to say that, just in case.
I don't think it is.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
It's got a few coming on.
I've done 30 odd years of it. I don't think it's, you know, it's not like, you know, having to build a road or
building. Oh, okay, I know what you mean.
You know, it's just talking.
Yeah. So I thought you were saying.
I mean, there's this planning and thinking and certainly in creating this, but it's still, you know, if somebody said when you were at school, you know, you get to sit around, drink tea and scribble on bits of paper and talk to each other, you'd go, I'll have that.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember at school they'd say, don't watch the telly, you do your own work. Well, the watching the telly was actually my own work. That's what helped me later on in life.
Yeah. But the thing is, you don't know if the butterfly effect would have flipped. If you'd done more homework, you might have.
Who knows? My mum died when I was 11, so I was very gregarious before then. I was more into physical activities, football and stuff like that. And then after my mum died, I became more bookish. So I'd read a lot. And so I think that probably had the biggest effect on me getting into something creative. I think if my mum hadn't died, she died in a car crash, I think I would have been a greengrocer.
Right.
It's true, because we ran a greengrocer's business. Okay. My mum ran a greengrocer, and I used to wig off school on a Thursday and Friday, and I'd go on the van with her and sell potatoes.
I didn't know you had a greengrocer. That's why it was so random to me.
It sounds random, but you know, there you go. Yeah.
Okay.
There was a logic to it.
Yeah, definitely. And in The Independent, I read a interesting quote review of what they called you.
Yeah.
They basically said, you're the funniest person that you've never heard of.
That's a lovely quote. I don't necessarily think it's true, but it's, you know, I quite like not being an household name. I quite like the fact that I can get on a bus or a train and nobody knows who I am. And I quite like being funny when I want to be funny, as opposed to, you know, being under pressure to be funny all the time. I love writing gags, and I love working with other people who are funny, and I love making television programmes and things like that. But the idea of being funny all the time just fills me with dread.
Yeah, I think it when it doesn't feel like a job, it's fun.
Yes.
And when it feels like...
It's about expression, I think. You know, we'd lovely to think that you're an artist. Now, I don't think you're necessarily an artist all the time. I don't think even artists are artists all the time. And I think when you're not an artist, it's nice to be a craftsman. And when you're not a craftsman, it's nice to do a job well. Beyond that, we're probably all opportunists, aren't we? So there's an element of each of those things. You aspire to be an artist when you can.
Yeah, definitely. And so was it, I don't want to say a conscious move, but was there a time when you sort of decided, I don't necessarily want to become a household name, so I'm not going to follow that as much as maybe, because you've named quite a lot of other people who everyone will immediately have a face in their head and be able to think of, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but I wasn't quite sure what I was, to be honest with you. And I didn't want to be Bernie Winters. If you're going to be famous, you've got to be famous for being something. And I mean, Steve's a brilliant character actor, and whether it be serious or funny. And so it was quite easy for me. I go, oh, right, so he's a character actor and that's what he wants to be. And Caroline is a great character actor. I didn't want to be a character actor. That's not what I want to be. In a way, I think I want to be a poet. I don't think poets are that famous these days. I don't think the sort of poet that I want to be is not really around so much at the moment. I'm a big fan of Robbie Burns as a poet. There's something about the everyman quality to him, and his verse being accessible that I like, and his lifestyle that he was concerned with epitomises a way forward. Probably what I'm going to be striving for, but that doesn't fit in with television, and it certainly don't fit in with earning a living. So I needed something to do in the meantime. So I was very lucky to know Caroline and Craig and to get on with it and have fun. And we did have a lot of fun making those programmes, and you know, I'm very proud of all the programmes that we made. So I got to a stage where we decided to write this new thing called The Royal Family. And Caroline, Craig and I sat in a room. I think David set off to do his own thing and is now brilliant at doing that. We sat in a room and we sort of wrote down what his mother and fathers had said. So the first line of The Royal Family is, in episode one, is "Who's been phoning Aberdeen?" It was all about the fact that our parents had said so many things to us over the years. And I think we wrote the first episode in about 2 hours, and it just was free flowing. It was like a stream of consciousness, and there was no plot to it or anything like that. Caroline was particularly adamant that it was done in real time, and that Craig and I used to say, "Can we go into the kitchen?" And she said, no, we're staying in the living room. Just what now? Think of something else. And so we were trying to keep it very minimal. And I think we had the first two episodes very quickly. I think within about a fortnight, we had the first two episodes. And then we were a year trying to sell it because nobody understood it in the way that we wanted to do it. Now, luckily, because Caroline, you know, was famous for Mrs. Merton and they trusted her and everything, they said, that's great. But then they didn't like that her character wasn't the lead character. And they kept saying, but nobody says anything nice to anybody. It's like they don't like each other. And we're going, no, that's what Northern families are like. They're like that. So we had a lot of persuading to try and say, you know, this is... how it should be. We filmed a pilot, a multi-camera. We then, I think Caroline buried in her garden because it was so bad.
Right.
And then we got Mark Mylod in as a director, and we shot on film and we did it single camera.
And was it, this was with baby cat? Like, as in,
No, this was with Granada.
Okay.
So the Mrs. Merton Show and Royal Family were Granada programmes for BBC. A chap, really, we've all got to thank is Andy Harris. Andy Harris didn't get too involved in the nitty-gritty of the creative side. He left that to us, and I think that was part of his genius. He got the money, he got it through, and so you never had to worry about that. So all you had to concentrate on was the creative side. Anything that I've done as a producer, I put down to having watched Andy do his thing, and he was perfect for that.
Okay. And oh, sorry, go on.
And on the Steve's side, the early programmes we made with Steve, Paul and Pauline Calf, Coogan's Run, Tony Farina, were all made with Positive, which is Jeff Posner and Dave Tyler.
Okay.
And they certainly got the eye for those programmes, and I don't think they'd have put us in such a good position and been so well received if it weren't them. So we were very lucky to work with them.
I was asking because I think something like, you know, the whole romanticised idea of comedy being, you know, like a full-time performer and managing to make your money from the thing you want to do.
Yeah.
It was just interesting to hear that you wanted to be a poet, but you knew that you needed to find another stream of income because that wasn't going to cut it. And I think it's for me anyway, it's nice to hear that because I want to be a comedian, but that at the moment isn't cutting it in terms of money. So I'm trying to find other avenues that will hopefully either get that to happen or to cover it. And I mean, you said at the start when you started, there wasn't really a business angle, there wasn't as much corporateness. I mean, was this, you were getting older and so you were thinking about it in terms of, you know, I want to move forward in life, things like getting a house and stuff, or was it just an organic...
Well, I was lucky in a way that I was dealing with people that were friends. So we got into dealing with the Mr. Merton Show and Paul Calf. Whether or not they were paying us, these were fun things to do. And even though I wasn't doing, you know, going off on my journey of being a poet, doing a few performances around the time, which was nice because it reminds you you're still funny. You know, there were fun games to play making these things. So I enjoyed that. Once we'd done the Mrs. Merton and Malcolm, which was a show that Caroline Craig and I did after Royal Family, Steve asked me to write a film, The Parole Officer, which we'd thought up together. So I had to talk to Craig and Caroline and say, this is going to take me a while. I won't be able to do the second series of The Royal Family. I said to them, if you do a one-off, I'll have time to do that, but I won't have time to do a series. And they said, no, we're doing a series. So I wrote The Parole Officer, which we wrote 12 drafts of in the room just above here. Fourth draft was funny, and after that it went downhill. and it was interesting writing that, as neither Steve and I had written a film before. In fact, we went to a place in Brighton, some night class to teach us how to do a film. It's absolutely dreadful, and Steve used to sit up the back and pretend to be a naughty schoolboy. But we learned enough from doing the actual process. And I say doing 12 drafts that certainly put us in good stead for, you know, doing narratives from then on. But whilst we were doing that, Steve asked me if we wanted to form a company together which we could run out of Brighton, because he'd got a daughter in Brighton, and I was just about to have a son. So I had a little think about that. And said yes, and we set up Baby Cow whilst we were writing The Parole Officer.
Okay, and what were you? Did you have like secured funding for The Parole Officer at the time, or how were you?
Yeah, no, The Parole Officer was made by DNA Films. If you look on Google for DNA Films, you'll see that there was a lot of controversy at the time that they'd made a lot of films and were getting a bigger slice of funding than a lot of the other companies. The Andrew had just made Train Spotting, so he was very much in vogue, and we wanted to work with him because, you know, Train Spotting obviously has an edge to it, and we were trying to do something at the time with a bit of edge. And Duncan Kenworthy had done 4 weddings and a funeral, so he obviously knew how to do popularist stuff, and our plan was to do something in between the two. Unfortunately, Andrew went off to do the beach. Andrew McDonald went off to do the beach. Duncan took over, and it moved more towards the mainstream side than the edgy side. So I don't think either Steve or I were particularly happy at the end of the day with the film. But, you know, it was a exercise, and you know, I think it's a decent film. Just not a particularly brilliant film.
And so before we go into Baby Cow, pre-Baby Cow, obviously it all vary year on year, but it sounds like proportionately of like sort of how you were staying out the red, shall we say, like it sounds like poetry was sort of a very small snippet of that. And then...
Well, by the time we got to this stage, I was earning so much, because as I say, I was working with Steve and Caroline, that I wasn't, didn't have time to do the poetry.
Oh, you weren't even okay.
No, not to when we got to the Prolofs. So no, I'd been, because there's about 5 years from Mrs. Merton through to the Prolofs.
So if you took it from your first Edinburgh to just before Baby Cow, that time period,
about 5 years, yeah.
Yeah, so you would have been doing poetry at the start, obviously, because you went to Edinburgh.
Yeah, about for about 2 years in, and then 3 years without. Yeah.
Obviously, when you started earning good money from writing,
there
comes a time when you get... So, for example, when I get like a nice writing contract, you sort of have to question... Because you obviously can't do everything time-wise. Yeah. It's just not going to happen. So, obviously, you had sort of priority orders of having to shift around whether you would go with a writing project or whether you would...
It was everything that Caroline did, I was going to do, and everything that Steve did, I was going to do. Steve and Caroline didn't do things, you know, without me at that point, apart from Steve doing stuff with Armando and Patrick on the radio at that time, and obviously Partridge, which I wasn't involved in the early Partridge. So it was quite a full-time job, but doing the two, I mean, I had to work weekends and nights, so I didn't really, it wasn't a question of can fit some sort of stuff in. I could hardly fit in doing the two, and there did get times when I tried to be in two places at once, and it caused a lot of stress trying to be, because they both had deadlines, you know, with both Steve and Caroline and Craig. Caroline, they've got very high quality to the work, so you know, even if you're working on a small thing, you overwrote and, you know, and really worked at it, and you know, didn't settle for things being good enough. You made them brilliant. I mean, Steve, I would say, probably from more or less everything he writes, probably writes at least 4 times as much as he needs. And so I wrote the tours with Steve and Peter Bainham, and, you know, we, for an hour and a half tour, we would probably write, you know, about 6 hours worth of material.
So I'm just in my head working out how much I've probably written to work out for my own.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, funny enough, you mentioned gag rates earlier. I always remember The Man Who Thinks Is It, if you get the DVD of that. I once timed that to see how many gags a minute there was. There's a gag every 12 seconds. Like when I say gag, a laugh, an audience laugh, where the audience all laugh. Every 12 seconds.
As in an audience, not a recorded, like, audience laugh that they have now.
Because they were recorded in front of a live audience. I think for the whole of the 90 minutes, every 12 seconds on average, because I sort of timed it, I think that's phenomenal. I'm not sure how many people can hit that sort of pace. That's because Steve was, as I say, honed down 6 hours material to 1.5 hours, and you know, he was very precise with what he does.
Definitely. And so you set up Baby Cow, when was that,
1989.
Oh, 99, sorry. Okay.
Yeah. It's the same time as Google.
Okay.
They've done a little bit better.
Well, it depends. They've not made many films.
They're probably about to.
They own everything. Yeah. So when you set up Baby Cow, what was there a mission for that? Or was it just to make more TV and have more control over what you were doing?
One, it was to be able to be in control ourselves. The you know, there's a bit of attraction of it being Brighton based, but I don't think we felt that we were we were fully in control of some of the more recent things that were happening, that it would be nice to have the final say.
Because TV has, or the commissioner would have an overriding veto?
Well, not the commissioner. I mean, you're always having to deal with commissioners, but just in the producing side of things. So that was good, and it was an adventure. We wanted something, you know, something new to do. You know, having done a film, you sort of think, well, right, okay, I've done TV, I've done film. What's the next adventure? So it was a great little adventure. The first person we called was Julia Davis, because Julia had been on Steve's tour, The Man Who Thinks Is It, with Simon Pegg. It was a hell of a tour, that. So we rang Julia up, and she said she wanted to do something with Rob Brydon, and we'd never heard of Rob Brydon, so brought Rob Brydon over here to this house. We met him, and he seemed a nice bloke, and he gave us a tape that he'd made, 10 minutes of a thing called Marion and Jeff. When they'd gone, Steve and I put it in the, I think it was a VHS, and watched it. And then Steve looked out that window, and I looked out that window, because we both got a tear in his eye, and said, oh, that's brilliant, we're going to have to do that. So the first two programmes that we made were Marion and Jeff and Human Remains with Julia and Rob, and they both won awards. I think both of them won an RTS. That was the first award ceremony we went to.
How many... Because it sounds like in the early days it was just friends telling you about ideas they'd had. I mean, were there unsolicited scripts starting to come in from the start? Or?
There was. So we had an office in Brighton, and we'd done a deal with the BBC that they would give us 2 years, that they would give us a guaranteed output. So we knew we were going to make some stuff, and so they opted for those two as the first two shows.
How normal is that, by the way? Like, as in how?
I think it's because Steve had done so well with Partridge. I mean, at the time, words like vanity deals were put about, but Steve was very adamant it wouldn't be a vanity deal, and we made sure that Steve wasn't in the first two shows that we did, so that, you know, that wouldn't come over as anything. So the first show Steve was in that we made was Dr. Terrible. Dr. Terrible came about because Graham Duff, who lives locally, popped into the office that we had in Brighton, and he put, I think it was 3 sides of paper of an idea called Dr. Terrible's House of Horrible. And Steve was in the office one day, and he picked it up and he laughed, and he said, let's get this bloke in. So we got Graham in, and he's such a lovely bloke, Graham, so he instantly liked him. And we just laughed at the clumsiness of some of the way the Hammer House was made, and the sort of the fondness that we had for them. We just were thinking up ideas for different stories, and just, you know, it's like being a kid again. You're just thinking up, having a laugh at this sort of make-believe that you're going to do. So we got a script commission off the BBC. Graham, Steve and I wrote Dr. Terrible between us. I think the way it used to happen was Graham would talk through a first draft with me, and then he'd write it up, and then I'd add to that, and then we'd show it Steve, and then Steve would add to it. Because Steve was away, I think he did, whilst we were doing the main writing on that, he was doing Partridge.
So it was very, very much tandem projects at that point. You weren't sort of focused on one?
No. I think to run a company, you've got to have more than one thing happening at the same time. And of course, with narrative comedy, you have to have scripts lined up. I mean, this became very evident about 2 years down the line, when we'd made Dr. Terrible and we made Human Remains, and I was waiting for the next script to come in, because you can often take quite a bit of time. We were paying out monies. It seemed like we might go bust. I'd got no scripts to make, so I didn't know what to do. And I came home and I went to bed in my suit, and pulled the blankets over me, and thought, how are we going to survive? How are we going to survive? And the next day, I went in to see Stuart Murphy at BBC Three, and I sold him a programme called How to Survive, which we renamed Brain Candy, which was 42 comics, including John Bishop, Alan Carr, Jimmy Carr, and Noel Fielding, and loads of comics that are now Robin Ince, you know, loads of comics that are now sort of on the television, doing stand-up. But the way we did the stand-up was we shot them on location. We changed it into themes, so like crime, parents, sex, you know, different themes. And we juxtaposed so that, you know, each comic had one joke. And we did, I got Fatboy Slim's company to give us some music. And we did some animation. And we made this mixture of stand-up with music, animation. And when we did that, I think we did 14 episodes of that. That helped the wheels to keep rolling. We did a similar thing called Wine Gums with poets. So this was about, because we didn't have scripts, about getting pre-existing material. So I got John Cooper Clarke and John Egley and all these poets onto a similar sort of thing where I juxtaposed them with music and animation. And then we did a thing on Shakespeare where I got a lot of the comics we were working with, to people like Mark Lamar and people like that, to do bits of Shakespeare to camera, and we did a similar thing with those. So those three shows filled a gap where I'd got no scripts, and by the time we got to the end of those, I'd got scripts, and we were able to continue in business.
And if I remember correctly, 1999 or around that time was when like Channel 5 was launching, and there were new channels opening up. Is that right?
Channel 5 didn't really do anything for us, but we did go in, but I think their stuff was so mainstream and we didn't want to be mainstream. But BBC Three was a huge opportunity for us. The first show on BBC Three, Steve and I wrote, it was called Paul and Pauline Cast's Cheese and Ham Sandwich. That was the first ever show on there, and our relationship with Stuart Murphy, ever since then has been great. And obviously later on when he moved to Sky, we started doing anything with Sky. Had anybody else approached us from Sky, I'm not sure we'd have worked with Sky. But still, such a great bloke, and essentially had saved the company. That him and Lucy Lumsden, who was on our first show at the BBC, she was on Human Remains. When she moved to Sky, the fact that it was Stuart and Lucy meant we had no qualms about dealing with Sky, whereas I think we might have done before then because of the Murdoch involvement.
The only reason I was doing that, I've got my questions written down here.
That's right.
And I remember when I asked people what they'd like to ask you. I'll be honest, I've not seen every program you've worked on, but someone asked me, now that you've stopped doing Baby Cow, will you finally finish building your hovercraft? And I was trying to remember whether it was on that show.
That was from Coogan's Run.
Yeah.
Ernest Moss. I played Steve's brother in Ernest Moss, and I was the chief engineer on the hovercraft project. Mm. I think it was only one line, but it's fun that they'd remember that.
Mm. Yeah, no, I've got it here down, A Handyman for All Seasons.
Yeah,
it
was, yeah. That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it was because we'd written that we got the opportunity of doing the film. Andrew McDonald said he'd seen that and it was so well structured that he thought we could write a film. So it's great when you work on something and that leads to something else, and then that leads to something else.
When you first went to Edinburgh, you won an award. Did that help you get the TV? Was that what helped
I think the fact that John Egley didn't want to do the TV show and they're looking for another poet, okay, and I happen to be a funny poet,
okay,
was being in the right place at the right time.
And I assume there were obviously less comedians and less poets up there at the time, so obviously that helped that massively. And then you were saying that, like, the first time you did a show, obviously that also won awards, and so that helped launch you a bit more as well. Because I'm just wondering, at the moment, there are more awards than there have ever been.
Oh, I've grown to 8 awards. As Baby Cow, we've won hundreds of awards, and we've won more awards. I used to, in the early days, the first couple of years, I'd count how many programmes we've made, how much made in terms of duration, how many awards we'd won, how many awards we'd been nominated for. And after a bit, I stopped counting because we got so many. But I sort of, in the early days, it was, there was a sort of sense of there were awards worth winning, like the BAFTA and the RTS award and Montreux. But nowadays, I won't name them, but there's so many awards where they're just excuses to get famous people to turn up in a room.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine there's a lot of those. And I mean, it's diluted a little bit, some of the ones that were more meaningful, in my opinion, anyway.
Yeah.
And
what they do, you've got awards for soap operas now. You know, and all sorts of things. And they go on for so long. And they're not in any way as glamorous as they look on the television. I mean, if you've been to the Comedy Awards, you're sat, there's no food on the table, so everybody gets drunk, and then they complain that you get drunk, and you've got cables underneath your feet, and you're cramped together. You can't move your chair back because there's another person trying to move their chair back behind you. So it's not glamorous in any way. Of course, when you first start and you're young and you're in a room full of people who are sort of comedy gods, as you get older, you know everybody in the room, and there's nobody older than you, so you just think, oh right, okay, I can see these people
whenever
I don't have to be in this room. I can just see them tomorrow for a cup of tea.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, in terms of Baby Cow, I know on your website it says we don't accept unsolicited scripts at the moment. Yeah. And when I spoke to Anne Edervin at the BBC Writers' Room, she said that they're not looking for scripts, they're looking for writers. Is that the same at Baby Cow?
We encouraged people to send us scripts for the first 10 years, and I had a person, it was actually Benny Hill's nephew, used to read them. I paid him, and he'd sit there, and that's all he'd do all day. He'd read scripts, and he'd pass on the ones that were any good, and we did come up with a few programmes based on stuff that had been sent in. But as we got more successful, we got more and more. So, I mean, he couldn't keep up with them. I wasn't going to employ two people to read them. So eventually we just got so much going on that I said, we just have to stop. I mean, I wanted to, because I'm from a community arts background. I wanted to have that access to people. Nearly everybody's got an agent nowadays. Agents approach us and they say, you know, we've got this up-and-coming person, they've got this script, can I send it? And we always say yes. So, you know, although it says on the website, don't send us a script in, people do.
I mean, that's interesting. So it's essentially...
There's still somebody there that reads scripts.
Yeah, I imagine there would be. But I'm wondering, just from what you said there, is there a gatekeeper lock then that is opened by agents more so there?
No, if you sent a script in now, I guarantee somebody would read the letter that you've sent with it, and if that don't put them off, then they'll read the first few pages. If you don't laugh within the first five pages, if you imagine it's about a minute a page. So if it was on the television and you're 5 minutes in and you don't laugh, you're going to turn over.
Yeah.
So you only have to read the first five pages just to sort of see whether or not it's worth reading the rest of it. Mm. So they'll probably do that.
Yeah, fair enough. And, I mean, TV is evolving quite a lot at the moment. And like we were talking about before, it's merging a lot with the internet.
Yeah.
And you even said that sort of the most recent Partridge stuff has basically been online stuff, really. Like it went from the film and then...
Well, it's a spoof of online stuff. But the problem with the online stuff is you can't monetize it in the way that you can monetize a full series. So you take a program like Gavin and Stacey. You know, obviously a lot of money was made on Gavin and Stacey. You wouldn't make that money if it was on the internet.
Have you ever tried to do it on a
yes.
system? Okay, how did you try? And
the first comedy series on the internet of any substance was one that we made called Where Are the Joneses, and we got money from Ford, and we made 84 uploads. I think they're still up there with Emma Fryer, and we went all around Europe in a car, and the idea is that she finds out that Dad was a sperm donor, and she goes to try and find all the other brothers and sisters. I was on the BBC World Service talking about this at the time, and I was on Channel 4 News. And what we did was we made it in a way that we'd do an episode, there'd be an episode on today, and then we'd say, so what do you want to happen next? and people had, this was at the beginning of Twitter, Twittering. I can remember thinking that's never going to last, that Twitter rubbish. They're Twittering, and then we'd have a look at that, and then we'd select what we like the sound of. We'd ring it through to where the writers, performers and production were, Amsterdam, Madrid, wherever they were. They would then work that into the script, film it that day or the next day, and then it would be on the internet as the episode that was on in 2 days' time. And we did that over the 84 runs and tried to do as much interaction. So we'd have people making their own sort of storyline, and then their camera would point at us as our camera pointed at them as we passed.
Right.
And we'd have things of, who do you want to be in the show? And then we'd get them in the show. So we tried to make it in a different way, using the medium. So that was made years ago. So we tried to, now we managed to do that because we got a corporate sponsor for it. So having done that, I tried since, which is how the Fosters thing came about, tried since to try and find ways to monetize, and we did do a lot of different things to try and make the internet work. But the amount of money that you make by making a show for terrestrial TV, for everybody involved, the amount of money you make for making anything for the internet are vastly different, in the way that making something on radio is very different from making something on television.
Does that so I've never made anything for TV before. I've got a script idea, but I've never, like, I haven't produced it yet, if that makes sense. So but I've made I make internet content, and I've both video and audio, and so my question would be, do you get obviously, you get paid more if it does well, because you can sort of make money on royalties and syndications and DVD sales and that kind of thing. But up front, is it a case of you...
Well, let me give you an idea of the scale. So I've done radio shows, and a radio show's maybe in total would cost about 20 grand to make. A standard sitcom or comedy narrative on television is... lower end, 140,000 per half hour, or upper end, 350,000 per half hour. How much do you make this for?
A little bit less.
Yeah.
I think the total cost for all my... forget my laptop, because I had that anyway. Yeah. So total cost for all this equipment, I think, was about 600 quid when I bought it all. Like first hand, so we're talking recorder, memory card, mics, cable leads. And then I had the software on there. I would say at total, maybe 800 quid. Yeah.
Now, artistically, you can do just as much on radio, you can just as much on the internet as you can do on television, if you use your artistic intellect, but. But the idea of a business getting involved in the internet, it's you couldn't sustain a business. Whereas I say with those sort of figures, if you're making five series a year, and there's six episodes per series, then your turnover's sort of 6 to 10 million.
Hmm. I can see that, yeah. So I'm just working out stuff in my head now, as to because there are a lot of people I know who are making their own sort of pilots and putting them online, and it's not costing anywhere near those figures. And if it was, they won't be doing it.
Yeah. Well, the problem with when you start getting into traditional media is that the clearances of things like music, and the clearances of archive, and the amount of money you have to pay actors, and equity minimums and things like that, it's very different from something which has got this sort of creative freedom, where you're not bound by the same rules and regulations.
Don't you save a lot of money by being on the BBC music royalty wise?
You save some, but
okay.
If you want to put that out on DVD, if you want to put it out, you want to sell it around the rest of the world, then you've got to pay for that. So you take a show like Marion and Jeff. So there's music in Marion and Jeff that we wanted to be in the on the BBC. But some of that music, they wouldn't allow you to put it on DVD. They wouldn't allow you to play it in America. So you either have to change the music or you have to pay.
Okay, makes sense. And when you're picking writing projects, because you've done so many different sort of shows and mediums and things, how do you pick between stuff that gets offered to you and stuff that just comes your way? Like, what's your process for deciding what you do and what you don't do?
Well, over the years with Baby Cow, it's just been a question of you have to find it funny yourself. Because if you don't find it funny, how are you going to make it funny? And that's so. Every year we'd go up to Edinburgh and we'd look at stuff. So the Boosh came out of having seen them in Edinburgh, and you know, people would send scripts in and we'd read them and see whether or not we felt they were funny, or you'd meet somebody, or you'd go to see a performance. So it really is just a matter of taste, and I would hope if you looked at the stuff that we've made at Baby Cow over the 16 years, that there is a sort of style. The way I would characterise it is, I think it's about level of obviousness, that we don't like things too obvious. That there's a sort of sense of, we try to be a little bit more sophisticated, try to be a little bit warm. We don't make anything cynical or sexist, racist, or that does anybody down. We want everybody to laugh and feel good about the show, and not feel insulted that it's beneath them. I think there are programs been made over the years where they sort of think that people are a bit thick, so they've got to make them a bit obvious, and we've never done that because Steve and I are probably a little bit snobby.
Fair enough. I think if you're going to be snobby, do it with your own company. And you know,
yeah. And we want to. The rule we said when we first set out is that we'd only make things that we like.
Mm.
And we'd only make things that we would watch.
Mm.
And if we wouldn't watch them, why are we making them?
Yeah. I keep saying this to people. I think the why you do something is way more important as to what you're doing.
Well, it helps you choose, as you say. And so, funnily enough, when you say what you choose, that's so ingrained that I don't think any of my staff even think of it in those sort of terms. That they just read it and think, is that something we do? And you know, by the mass of stuff that we've done, you sort of get a gauge of what we do. People still send us stuff in that we wouldn't do, but majority of stuff seems to be on the right sort of lines.
And I read that the BBC owns 25% of Baby Cow. But when you...
They own more now because I've sold my shares, but yes.
I was going to ask, yeah.
Previously, yeah.
Yeah, so you sort of net like 73% or something like that. Yeah. Is that sort of a move that you're... Was that you trying to sell it to a place that you thought it would be best at, you know, like best...
Well, yes, it's a little bit like... it's a little bit like marrying your daughter off. You want her to have a good life, and you want her to feel loved, but you don't want her to live in your house for the rest of your life. So you find an happy medium. I think the BBC as an institution has held the torch for comedy over many years, and most of the best comedy programmes have been made either by or for the BBC over the years. The personnel changes, and you know, there's some great individuals at the BBC at any one time. And but as an institution, I think it's worthwhile, and I think BBC Worldwide as their corporate arm has a great future. And the people I was talking to at BBC Worldwide appreciate what we've been doing at Baby Cow, so it seemed to me a good fit.
And where do you see TV going in maybe the next 1, 2, 5 years, maybe? Because if you're sort of, it sounds like you're stepping out of that arena. Is there a reason for that because of the way you're seeing it going, or is that something else that you're?
No, the reason for that is that I've done enough television and films, and I've built a company to an extent that the challenge now really is to find something that's more personally creative for me. So not needing to think about the security, I'm hoping to go on the adventure I should have gone on about 30 years ago.
Okay, but where do you see TV going in the next?
Where do I see TV? I'm not sure, as I'm an expert. I have an insider knowledge. In terms of comedy, there's always new comics coming up. I've always felt it's a weird arrangement that 60 million people in the country watch the television, and the amount of people who get to choose what comedy's on the television comes to about 10 people. So that sort of system of choosing the programs that go on, I would love to see widened out, and I would love to see it more eclectic, because I think it, there's a natural tendency for the incumbent people making the decision to go with their own tastes rather than give enough for different tastes. I think with comedy, you know, I'd say I like Spike Milligan, but I equally liked Sid James. So you've got to have a wide enough brief with the comedies that there's something for everyone.
I normally, so we're about to go into the quick fire last questions.
Okay.
The quick fire for me, you take as long as you like.
Yeah.
Although we have got 6 minutes left.
I should be very quick.
One of the questions I always ask is, what's the biggest problem in the comedy industry and how would you solve it? Would that be your answer to that one?
No, because I don't think television's the be-all and end-all of the comedy industry. I think the biggest problem in the comedy industry is people aren't expressing themselves and saying what they want to say. What's happening is people are thinking, what do you want to hear? And they're then providing material for what people want to hear. I'd say get back to creativity and make something funny based on a new and original view of the world.
Mm. I'd completely agree with that. What is the biggest mistake you've ever made and how did you overcome it?
It's the biggest mistake I've ever made. Oh, God. I fell off a bike when I was 7 and broke my front tooth. So I've spent the first 20 years of my life not being able to smile. So I don't smile on any photographs.
Okay.
I'll stick with that.
Okay, then. What is the most interesting thing you do that nobody ever gets to see?
Well, I get to see all the programmes that don't get made, there's a lot of brilliant people doing brilliant stuff that deserve to be on television or film or have a wider exposure, and I've been very lucky to meet some talented geniuses that are yet undiscovered.
Brings me on neatly to the next question. Who is the most underrated person in the industry?
Who's the most underrated? There's a lot of underrated people, I would say. Of the new people coming up, I like Sean Walsh a lot. I think he's going to have a great future ahead of him. There's a few old guard that that I think are still got a lot of life in them. I think Steve's very underrated. People are always looking to Steve to say who's the man behind Steve. Well, Steve's the man behind Steve. He's a very clever bloke. There's lots of people. There's a new film coming out with called Mindhorn that I'm a producer on with Julian Barrett from the Boosh. I'm glad to see him back doing stuff because. You know, the Boosh were, to me, were fantastic. I was hoping that we'd make a film with them, but it never came about. So for him to now get into films, I'm hoping he makes a great success of that.
Definitely. No, I was a big fan of the Boosh, so that's cool. What is the best advice, bit of advice you've ever been given? It doesn't have to be something you've actually used. It could just be something that someone's told you.
My sister said that she was given a bit of advice that I've taken on board. She says that somebody once told her, if it's wet and it's not yours, don't touch it.
Okay, I like that. And if you could go back to your 20-year-old self and give you one bit of advice, what would it be?
Have more sex.
Okay, fair enough. Well, we'll leave it there.
All right.
Thank you very much for coming on.
Cheers, thanks a lot.
During the editing process of this, I had to stop several times to write some notes. I do that with all my pods because at the time I'm so in the conversation that I don't realise a lot of the stuff they're saying, which I know sounds a bit weird, but it was just so many things that I was thinking, that's great, oh, that's amazing. And we got sidetracked quite a bit and I had to edit out random little deviations from the narrative because as much as some of them are in there, I just didn't want to put out a 4.5-hour podcast or whatever it ended up being. So yeah, I hope you enjoyed that. I hope there wasn't much filler in there and there was all content that could be perceived as useful or at least be applicable to somewhere in your career. If you're enjoying this podcast, please share it with a friend. It really helps out and it really does expand the audience and help get people talking about the subjects that we're talking about. So if you can do that, please do that. As always, you can join the Facebook group, subscribe and give us a review. If you can donate, that'd be great. If you can't, don't worry about it. On the website, there's an option of a one-off payment via PayPal, or you can become a patron for 80p an episode, or $1 is what it is, because it's an American currency. If you can't donate, please do one non-financial supportive thing for the podcast. That can be sharing this on your social media, this could be writing a review, it could be just joining the Facebook group. Honestly, all these things help because they make the community grow and they make it look better to future guests that I'm contacting. And oh God, I've got some amazing people lined up and some amazing people who are so close to confirming. And I've just got my date sorted for Edinburgh, which means I can book in some people who are going to be around at the festival, which is so much of an opportunity that I don't want to miss out on. So please do support the podcast in any way you can. I'm in Brighton 3 days this week that the pod has come out, the 23rd, 24th and 25th of May, and then on the 26th I'm in Kent, then I go to Loughborough and Derby on tour. The links are in the show notes. If you can come to any of those shows, please do support me. If you can't come to those shows, please tell a friend that is in those areas. That'd be really useful and really helpful. Obvious, all the obvious things, just please support some way if you can. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for supporting. Thank you very much for donating if you do. And I will see you all in about 10 days' time. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.